From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Lee Grant is my guest. In addition to being an Academy Award-winning actress and a fine director, Lee Grant has written an amazing memoir called I Said Yes to Everything. Included in the everything she has said yes to is being a guest on my show. So, Lee Grant, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks so much.
You know, we haven't had that many Oscar winners on the show, so I wonder if we could start there. Can you take us back to that night that you won the Oscar?
Well, you know, I had been nominated three times before. So I'd become pretty accustomed to being the runner-up and not the winner. And so when they said whatever they said for Shampoo, I thought they said Lily Tomlin. And I leaned forward, and I touched her on the shoulder. I said, congratulations, Lily. And she said, they said your name, Lee. So I was like, really? And so I went out in the aisle and went down to the podium, and I was thinking, you know, this is like the end of a certain era. I've won. I made it. And now, you know, I think things are going to be different from now on. And that's basically when I started to turn to directing, you know.
So it was kind of the end of your acting career. But, I mean, you did a lot of acting afterwards, but you felt like that was a crowning achievement?
I think it was, well, it was like you did it. Yeah. You know, you made it. It was like the end of a race, and I crossed the finish line, and I knew that at my age as an actress that my future was not going to be in starring roles. Somebody said today, I don't remember what it was, but they said you go from, you know, playing the lead to playing the attorney, you know, and really that's exactly what happened with me. I went from playing the leads to playing the attorneys. And so I knew I had to jump over the rushing waters to another rock, and I did.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about acting for the different mediums. You know, there's very few actors that I can think of who've moved successfully back and forth from movies to TV. There's James Garner, and there's you. I mean, there's not many people have done that, and you've been nominated for lots of Emmys. You won two of them. Lots of movie stars have been bad TV actors, and vice versa. So do you think there's a difference between acting for films and acting for TV?
The acting part is the same. It's the kind of parts you're given, you know. In film, it, anyway, in that period, in the late 60s and through the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, because that went through 76, you know. So those were like another 12 years of really kind of amazing films that were made then. Don't forget, Coppola was coming out, Ashby was coming out, Spielberg was coming out. It was all like a 10-year kind of high of great directors with great new projects that, you know, I was lucky enough to be involved with. And the TV was pretty remarkable, too. I did some wonderful things on television in those days. And now, looking at television today, I think that the series that are being on, the Game of Thrones, The Bridge, the Americans, you know, starting with what's the Italian?
Sopranos.
The Sopranos. I think starting with The Sopranos, there was kind of a regeneration.
Yes, I think the
fresh. Right.
Yeah, TV's like movies now, as opposed to then. But I mean, because when you did episodic TV, which you did quite a bit, I was watching some of the things you did. I watched your Fugitive. I saw you on The Big Valley the other night. And
oh, come on.
No, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, those were, you know, really corny shows. You know,
some of them were better than others.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But you were always good. It didn't matter whether... did you approach it that way? Like, I'm going to just do the very best I can, no matter how crappy the...
I'm a method actress. I'm, you know, and mm-hmm. I was a committed... the acting was sainthood. You know, it was the only thing I knew how to do well, really, really well. And it was a salvation to me, you know. And acting was a very holy thing. I went to the neighborhood playhouse. I was taught by Sandy Meisner, who came out of the group theater. So it was a lifesaver.
When you're making a movie, and you know, you mentioned in your book, you talked about Airport 77, and you knew when you made that picture that it was a terrible picture, but you were going to just do the best you could because you were making money, and that was what everybody did, was made disaster pictures. But what about a movie like Valley of the Dolls? When you went into Valley of the Dolls, I mean, there's no reason to think that it was going to be a bad movie. There's, you know, some great performers in the picture, and it's, you know, got a reputable director and so forth. Were you aware when you were making that movie that it wasn't going to be good?
Sure. Sure. But, Gary, that movie has lasted till now. It's become one of those...
Sure, it's a classic.
It's a classic. It's become a classic movie that everybody knows, and everybody knows the lines. You know, it was so bad that it became great. It's one of those funny things. It's a, what do they call it?
It's campy.
Yeah, camp movie that everybody knows everything about. So
when you were making it, you knew that it was not going to be good.
That it was not going to be nominated. No, but also don't forget that all of us as actors go, at that time anyway, went from one movie to another, and the experience of being in the cast and having friends there and being on a new location, and you know, mostly it was the experience of actors really hanging out with other actors, which was, you know, such a bond between us, and still is. Actors have a kind of family together. You know, no matter what you're in, you make a connection with another actor.
When you were when you were doing your acting classes back, before you became a star, what kinds of things happen in acting class? Do you do the same kinds of things as an acting teacher that you did when you were an acting student? What are the kind of the exercises that you do?
Well, I did a lot of improvisations, and when I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse. When I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse, the thing that opened me up the most was improvisation and having a strong objective and fighting against somebody else's strong objective. And it was that push of I want you, whatever it was that you want, I want you to leave the room. Of suddenly having an objective of wanting somebody to leave the room that evoked a kind of power in me that I never knew was there. And so basically it's one objective opposing another objective that's just as strong. I want to stay in the room. And the things that you do in order to accomplish what your objective is. And in every play and every film that you do, there is that situation and there is a new objective to carry out. You know, in Shampoo, it was, you know, to have that hairdresser, to have him to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever desperate action I would take to hang on to that hairdresser. In Airport 77, it was, you know, to survive.
Yeah. Even if it meant the death of everyone else.
That's right. You know it. So in each of these things, you know, there was the deep down acting objective that I hung on to, and so the life of the character came out of that.
How much do costumes and so forth, when you were doing Peyton Place, I was watching you do that the other day, and your hair, it's like kind of a helmet on your head.
Funny.
How much of the costume?
Gary, I've got to tell you.
Yeah.
I got to tell you. You know, the hairdresser rules the makeup room. I had just, you know, come out there from New York. Peyton Place was my first job after The Blacklist. And there was an iron-fisted 70-year-old hairdresser who had her hands on my head, and no matter how much brushing or combing I tried to do, she twisted those little curls on me so that, you know, so that my hair moved when my head moved, and there was no airy breezy thing to it. She dominated the makeup room, so there was nothing I could do about it until my next job.
But so now you're sitting there on the witness stand with this helmet on your head, but at the same time, you become this woman, you know, this, you know, who's fighting for the life of your, you know, what, I can't remember what the plot was. But so does that costume help or hinder?
The costume?
Yeah. Well, the costume, the hair, the makeup, the whole thing.
Oh, gosh. I don't, you know, sometimes it does. But, I you know, I don't remember what I wore as Stella Chernek. I just knew that I was on the wrong side of the tracks and that my father was dying. And Ryan O'Neill was picking on my brother, and what did they have me in court for?
Ryan O'Neill was accused of murdering your brother. You accused him of murdering.
I see. So I'd forgotten that. So you know, there I was defending my brother on the wrong side of the tracks, and I was defending him, I'm sure, very hard.
If you're flipping the channels and you see yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think, oh, I remember that, or is that, what is that? Did I do that? Which is it?
Yeah, both. Both. There are times where I go, what? Well, you know, when did I do that? Because I made so many films when I was out there, you know, on television. And then other times, you know, I get very moved, like when Heat of the Night comes on.
Yeah.
And
what a great film it is.
Such a great film. And the scene with Sidney is so sensitive and so tender, and so emotional, you know, that when I get to it, I feel it all over again. I really connect with what I was hit with, you know, with my husband being killed there in the South in that awful place. And so, you know, it depends. If it was Peyton Place and I saw myself on the stand, I'd say, what was that? But with Shampoo and with the other ones, you know, it just gives me, you know, a kind of connected feeling.
In the Big Valley, you were you have to tell you, you were supposed to be a school teacher, but actually you were a saloon girl, and your father was dying, and they came to get you. And you insisted on...
My father's always dying. I'm Peyton Place.
You insisted on wearing your saloon girl outfit.
Wasn't that Barbara Stanwyck, wasn't she?
That's right. Yes, Barbara Stanwyck. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, Miss Barbara Stanwyck.
Miss Barbara Stanwyck. Yes, indeed. She deserves that.
So, Lee Grant, you were blacklisted for a dozen years, and you tell the story in detail in your book, I Said Yes to Everything. But tell us why you, a nice Jewish girl, could be blacklisted. In fact, maybe it was because you were nice Jewish. Do you think that being Jewish had something to do with being blacklisted?
No, honey. No, unfortunately, the blacklist took up, Seventh-day Adventists and Catholics and Protestants and Jews, right across the board.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very bizarre era. It was the era of McCarthyism, and I had made a huge hit as an actress in a play called Detective Story, and made a movie of it. And that's when I was nominated for my first Academy Award, and I actually won the Cannes Film Award for Best Actress in 1952. And by the time I got that award, I couldn't work any place in film or television. So it was an action that I took to defend a fellow actor who had been a member of the Communist Party, and his name was Joe Bromberg, J. Edward Bromberg, who was a wonderful character actor. And when we were working together in a play on Broadway, he told me that he'd been called up in front of the Un-American Activities Committee and that he had a bad heart, and he felt that it was killing him. And so he left and ran away to London, opened in a play, and got great reviews, and had a heart attack and died. And so there was a memorial for him, which 2,000 people showed up at. And I was asked as a very young Broadway actress to speak for him. And I said that I felt that he died because the Un-American Activities Committee went after him, even though they knew that he had a bad heart. And 2 days later, I was on the list, and they listed me and said what my remarks were. And for 12 years after that, I couldn't work. And I have to say that most of the actors and writers that I knew at that time, particularly the actors, were liberals. They had given money to a lefty cause, or they'd spoken up some places I had, and unless they said, oh, the Red Channels is good, you know, blacklisting is good, they, you know, had the same fate that I did. So it was just a dark, a murky, terrible period in America at that time. And you know, it's so funny because the Blacklist is the most popular television show that's on now.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's so funny.
When you see that title, does it give you a kind of a...
Well, it sure did.
Yeah.
It sure did. You know, it has no connection to what has happened in our past or what happened to me and to hundreds and hundreds of other actors who, you know, suffered the same fate that I did.
How do you feel about those actors that, you know, Sterling Hayden or Lee J. Cobb or people who testified or friendly witnesses? Did you have, you know, how did you feel about them?
Well, I felt that they took a terrible way out to name other people, knowing that those that they named would also be blacklisted. But on the other hand, I knew that they suffered terribly, that their careers were at stake, and that they had to choose between their own decency, and they did have decency, and their own indecency, which was to name people, which, you know, it was a terrible kind of inquisition, Gary. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Inquisition, they burned the Jews, and they said, do you want to become a Christian and not be burned, or do you want to, you know,
right,
claim your Jewish faith and go up in flames? And I'm sure that a lot of Jews said, you know, I think I'll be a Catholic, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's not that different from century to century, from generation to generation, what people's choices are.
You mentioned Ilya Kazan in your book, and you said that you didn't speak to him for 20 years, but did you,
yeah,
did you ever speak to him?
Yeah, I did.
And I did. What happened when you did speak?
Well, you know, the world ends with a whimper, not with a bang.
Yeah.
You know, it was like one of those things. I mistook him for somebody else and said hi, but I, you know, I didn't recognize him. So, you know, that kind of overdo that you do when you can't think of someone's name, and you go, "Hi, how are you? I haven't seen you in a long time." So he was overjoyed, and I couldn't get back to being mean.
Yeah, you couldn't take it back.
No.
You, there's some people you name drop a little in your book, and that I want to know. You know, you just mentioned them. You say that, for instance, you just mentioned, just dropped it there, that John Garfield felt you up. I want to know more about that exactly. John Garfield, how did you know him? What kind of a guy was he, besides being one of the great actors?
Well, I didn't really know him. I know his daughter, Julie Garfield, really, really well. And I met John Garfield when I went on the road in Oklahoma, my very, very first job after graduating from mm-hmm. acting school. And he was in Awake and Sing in California when we got there, and I saw him in Awake and Sing, and he was just fantastic in it. He was remarkable. It was a great experience for me. And I went up and I told him, you know, how wonderful he was, being an acting student who had just gotten out of school. And he said, you know, can I drive you home? And I said, sure. And he just talked about himself and his family and his wife, Robin. I didn't know anything about Julie then. And as we arrived at the hotel, he casually put his hand on my breast, and I just as casually kind of took it off, but, you know, felt good about the whole thing, that my breast was worthy.
Garfield worthy.
That's right, Garfield worthy. Not bad. And I just wish that he would have kissed me.
Oh, he didn't kiss you, he just put his hand on your breast?
Yeah. Yeah, he was such a hunk, you know. He was so great. Such a bad boy. I love bad boys.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
What about Lenny Bruce? You talk about him in your book.
Well, I went into a lot of detail about Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
In my book. It was certainly not an intimate relationship. I was going with a reporter at the time who took me down to see him when they when the police took him off the stage and accused him of...
So you were actually there when he was arrested?
Yes. I was there that night when he was taken away and was accused of you know, what is the word for bad language that they can...
Obscenity.
Obscenity. He accused him of obscenity. And so through this reporter, we became friends, really supporters of him, as many, many unexpected people were supporters of him. A lot of middle-of-the-road and even right-wing reporters supported his right to say any obscene word he wanted to. It was so different than today, where they can say it on television, you know,
sure,
no problem.
Right. But, thanks to him, I guess.
It was kind of the Irish judge mafia that had put him on trial, and he was put on trial. And I attended those days in court when he was begging for the right to just be heard, to hear his act, you know, begging the judge to hear what he had to say. And the judge was so dismissive of him, you know. And it was, you know, being a blacklisted person, I still was blacklisted at the time that he was hauled into court, there was a great kind of simpatico between someone like Lenny and someone like me, because to me it was the same as being blacklisted for saying bad words. And so for a while, you know, we were really in touch, and then he went off back to San Francisco, and well, you know the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it was just another case of, you know, government telling an artist what he should and what he should not say.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments in your book that you just made me think of is when you were doing a soap opera in New York during your period that you were blacklisted, and you ran into Mike Wallace just as you'd been fired. And Mike Wallace said he would stick up for you if you had told him that you weren't a communist.
Yeah.
And you told him, you said, it's not a matter of whether I'm a communist or not.
No, you have a right to be. You're supposed to have a right to be whatever you want and to think whatever you want in this country. And
to say whatever you want, right?
And to say whatever you want. But in that period, you know, we had moved into a terrible kind of Cold War against each other, against our own citizens. And the ones who had the power to extort you, to get money from you, and force you to go back on your friends and your own beliefs were in ascendant at that time. And it's just so extraordinary, and it was to me then too, that the 60s, you know, went so much to the opposite pole as the 50s had gone to the right, that the 60s went to the left with the Vietnam War and with hippies and with free love and all of the things that you couldn't have in the 50s.
So were you surprised then when things went back the other way in the 80s and Ronald Reagan and so forth?
Well, you know, that's when I started directing.
Right, your films were very political, right?
Yes, and I was, and it was the first time that I had seen homeless people in the streets. In the when Ronald Reagan, who had been an informer for the FBI,
mm-hmm.
and had not permitted blacklisted people to speak up in his union when he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Right.
And so the documentary that I made for HBO was Down and Out in America, the first time I saw homeless people, and it won an Oscar, you know. And so, you know, from the 10 years where I had won for acting to the 10 years where it had come along for directing, it was, you know, very meaningful to me. It meant that, you know, I'd really crossed that road and that I could say what I want through film. And nobody would, you know, ask me to come in front of a committee because I had. And so I made a lot of documentaries after that in which I felt that my voice was able to be heard again, you know, as against the 50s.
And they were great. And, you know, the name Lee Grant, you know, it means a lot when you see it on a film, whether you see it in the credits as an actor or as the director.
Thank you, Gary.
And so I guess it's no surprise that you would have written such a marvelous book. I love the book. I said yes to everything.
Yes, you. I love that you love the book. Can I tell you something?
Please
about
do.
It?
Yes.
You have time?
I do. I have all the time.
Yeah, I hadn't written it to be published. I wrote it out in longhand.
Yeah?
You know, one inky scrawl after another, and gave it to my friend Roberta to type up, you know, and put into the computer. And I just really needed to know who I was at this point, you know, to face, you know, things about myself. And so it was such a relief and such a release to me to just put it down and to have people like you like it as much as you do means a lot to me. It really does.
Well, it was really like going on a journey with you, and I especially like it when you suddenly refer to the present day when you say, you know, tears are rolling down my face as I write this, or...
they were a lot during the writing of that book. Yep.
Did you have journals to refer back to, or did you just dig it out of your memory?
I've never written before. I didn't even write letters. I never wrote before. I think the only thing that I ever wrote down were my dreams,
huh.
You know, because some of them were so horrific and some of them were so interesting that in the last couple of years, in the last 10 years or so, I would write down dreams, but that was the only time I ever wrote anything. This was a big embarkment for me. And the scene that I went in on first that I really needed to deal with was when I was offered a play after being, you know, blacklisted for 10 years. And my husband, my then husband, Arnie Manoff, said, if you take the play, we're through. And I needed to write about that. It was a kind of crucial time in my life. And so I did write it, and then I never stopped writing. So it's been, you know, 5 years of writing every day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so are you going to stop, or do you have more to write?
I do want to write more. Yes, I do. I have more. Yep. And then don't forget there was half of the things I wrote never went in the book because the book is 450 pages.
Yes.
You know, they said, oh, we have to get rid of that. No, yes, we do.
Oh, well, then I hope there'll be a volume two, or, you know.
I hope so, too.
More things I said yes to.
More, yes. More of I said yes to everything.
Well, whether there's another book or not, I hope that we'll get another chance to talk, because I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and I thank you so much for being on From the Bookshelf.
I have enjoyed you too so much, Gary.
Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, the amazing Lee Grant. Her new book is called I Said Yes to Everything, a memoir. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.